Welcome to Talking Wrestling with Pond Water Day. My name is Justin Davis. As always, I am joined by the First Lady of the Art Anderson Fan Club, Miss Amy Vaughn, and by the man who counted Ric Flair's last three count, Mr. Super Dave Miller. Pond Water Dave, what's up, everyone?
How y'all doing tonight? Glad to be here. Excited for our show. Our guest will be with us shortly. Can't wait to have him on. You know, it's just a thrilling week. I've rewatched the match. Was more anxious watching it than I was refereeing it. So it's funny how a year later and the just all the emotion that was packed into it and just so many cool, just watching it back last night, things post-match that I had forgotten came back to me that I see, because like I even did a fist bump with Rick when he came back down the ramp and started fist bumping everybody. I didn't even remember that because I was concerned for him. So, you know, there you go.
Awesome. I like how you have a Ric Flair shirt on, don't you? Is that you have on? And then, of course, Justin has Justin has Jarrett, and I got the Four Horsemen.
And joining us now, Justin.
Yes.
Tell everybody who's with us.
We have a very special guest with us today, of course. The man. Sorry, I'm getting nervous now. I can't.
Hey, I'm Conrad Thompson, everybody.
It's Conrad
Thanks
Thompson.
For having me today.
Yeah. What's going on, Conrad?
Man, I'm excited to be here with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming. I gave this tremendous introduction. And
yeah. And I just couldn't find it all of a sudden.
And he botched it.
Well, you know what? We all live and learn. Thank you guys for blocking off some time for me today. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for blocking off some time for us because we know you're busy and we appreciate your time.
Definitely. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Listen, it's an honor to be on the Pond Water Show. It's my first time on the Pond Water Show in a long time.
Well, I didn't.
Hey, don't let it be your last.
No, right? Yeah. Hey, listen, just start sending me a link and you never know. I might stagger in every now and again.
Oh, don't think I won't every week.
Well, I'm for it. I'd be glad to.
Before we revisit the match, let's talk about your latest honor. You are now a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to say out loud, isn't it? Like
Tragos Luthez Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I didn't expect it. Don't know what to say. I'm humbled and grateful, and I don't feel worthy, but I won the Gordon Solie Award, which I'm the third recipient of, Gordon Solie being number one, Jim Ross being number two, and I'm the third recipient, and couldn't be more honored, and I want to do what I can to try to help the Hall of Fame there in Waterloo, be it the Dan Gable Museum or the TNT Hall of Fame, continue to grow.
It's tremendous. I mean, I can't think of anybody that deserves it more, honestly. I mean, You've been doing podcasts for 7 years. Everything you've touched in the wrestling business has turned to gold. You leave it better than you found it in every venture that you do. So, even though you're 7 years into it, I can't think of anybody that would be more deserving of it.
Well, I don't know about that. I appreciate you saying that. I do appreciate what you said about leaving it better than I found it. That is something I've tried to do in every aspect of my life. You know, I want to, as the doctors would say, do no harm. At the same time, I'm trying to add value to everyone's life. And hopefully we're doing that. You know, if I can add value in enough other people's life, boy, my life will be pretty awesome. And boy, that's working out right now. So it was a great honor to be there with all those. I mean, I went in the Hall of Fame with freaking Haku. How cool is that? Like, that shouldn't be. The little kid in me, if you told him, hey, one day you're going to grow up and get paid to talk about wrestling and Brother Love's going to be one of your best friends and you're going to marry Ric Flair's daughter. Man, that'd be pretty damn roll tide. And a cherry on top is, wait, I'm going to the Wrestling Hall of Fame. I'm the Forrest Gump of wrestling, Dave. It continues.
Well, I mean, look at it. You brought Bruce to prominence. I mean, all you did was get him to do what he does and put him out there and he's back where he wanted to be. Tony Schiavone, who was done, look at him. He's on three times a week now. Eric Bischoff's got a job with WWE and been back, and he's all over the place. Then you took a little indie referee that never been in front of more than 700 people and put him in front of 7,000. So, and millions worldwide.
Well, I wanted to text you the other day, and I got busy and forgot. Happy anniversary, Sugar. Congratulations. I don't know who was more excited about that event when it was all said and done, me, you, or Rick.
Oh, it was – I'm still excited about it. It just for listening to Cassio and Jeff go over it the other day, I literally teared up and cried twice on the way to work.
Wow.
Just because the magnitude of the whole event. I mean, Rick Flair aside, I mean, I got, when you called me and you asked me, hey, Dave, trying to put it all together, would you like the Rock and Roll Express versus the Horsemen, or would you like the Von Erickson Briscoes?
Yeah.
And without missing a beat, I told you that's a Sophie's choice, but I immediately said, give me the Briscoes.
Yes.
Because Briscoes are arguably one of the top three teams in the world.
All time.
Exactly. And
now, wait, Dave, you be honest. He said Von Erich, and you just went blank, and that's why you wanted them.
No, I said Briscoes.
Really? I would have thought as soon as he said Von Erich.
I know it.
Like, I would.
And it's not a slight to the Von Erichs, but the Briscoes, like I said, they're one of the top three teams in the world.
Yeah.
And Conrad, I really, the first time I ever got to really see them in action was sitting with Conrad at his house watching NWA. I believe it was Crockett Cup, and we saw the Briscoes in the main event. And I didn't realize just how good they were. And then I got to watch them WrestleMania weekend with Conrad and Mr. Regal.
Oh, yeah, that was unbelievable, wasn't it? What a match that was.
Oh, man. So getting to work with them, but it kind of hit me because one of them's gone now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's just such a shame. But
it is a shame, but it was a fun spot to put you in because as we're sort of laying out the card and have all the matches worked out, we're trying to do referee assignments and I know who we've got. I thought, okay, I need to take care of two folks here. I need to take care of my buddy who works on the research, Mr. Derek Sabato. He grew up in the Northeast Indies, CZW and cats like that. So, hey, let's give him next crazy four-way. It's going to have Nick Wayne and Takeshita and all that other talent, Allen Angels. I mean, my goodness, Gresham too, like just a who's who in a four-way. And then it's like, okay, now I got a couple of old school throwback style names and acts. And I know my buddy, every chance he gets, he'll just start spitting out. He like chokes and goes, Kerry Von Erich. I mean, it's just, it comes out of him. He don't even mean for it to. So if you got a Von Erich match on there and you've also got, you know, really the heart of Crockett Promotions was the Rock and Roll Express versus the Horsemen. And to be out there with on a show like that, probably the last ever Jim Crockett promotion show. Hey, let's let Dave pick. And he picked, and I was glad to have him there.
Did it surprise you?
Not really. I mean, you know, I would have probably picked our group chat is so obsessed with Crockett that I kind of thought, okay, it'll be this or the Von Erichs because of the Von Erichs. But to your point, you didn't say Von Erichs. You said the Briscoes. I don't think that was a wrong choice. But the best part of the weekend for me was the morning I asked you to do what you set now have 8x10s for. And all along, like, but before we had the idea, before I had Rick even committed, I was telling some of our friends in the group chat, hey, here's what I'm working on. And I'm not going to tell him beforehand because I know he'd just be a miserable son of a bitch. But the morning of, I'm going to ask him. So I knew all the way back then, before I even had the deal on paper, hey, I want to do this for Dave.
And see, I would have just assumed that you were going to get Tommy Young for it or try to get Charles Robinson for it.
Well, don't get me wrong. I would have loved to have had Charles. He's under contract for WWE. We did want Tommy, but my plan all along was there's going to have to be a guitar shot in there because if you're going to have Jeff Jarrett, you got to use a guitar. So I knew there'd be a ref bump. So let's put a recognizable ref in there and then let's bump him. And so when Tommy Young wasn't able to do it, and I really thought if we do it with Tommy, it'd have to be early in the match, which wouldn't have worked out. So when it became, hey, you know what? Let's get the most high profile referee. How many main events has this guy done at WrestleMania? Let's add as much star power in there as we can. I mean, I think Mike Chiodo should be in every wrestling Hall of Fame. So, hey, here's an opportunity to have, you know, the guy who did Hogan Rock in there for Flair Jarrett, Flair's last match. That's pretty cool. And then it was, okay, now we got to bump him and get Dave in there. And he was cool with it. He was excited to be there. It was a great opportunity for all involved.
And it was funny because you set me down and I was like, and I knew that there was travel issues. So I thought when we sat down,
Devon Erichs got stuck. I mean, Devon Erichs showed up to the building like during the show.
Yeah, I'm thinking that this, when he sits me down, I'm thinking he's, man, Devon Erichs aren't going to make it.
Yeah.
So I'm already in panic mode. So then he uses the word bump. And so I'm thinking, I'm getting bumped. And then it hit me when he said, bumping Kyoto.
Yes.
And you're going to ride and slide in and make the three. And I was just kind of like, and it was like, okay. And it was just kind of awkward for a second because I didn't know what to say. And I appreciated it, but I also was in that position that if it just said, you know, if you get emotional and if you just say one word, you're going to cry. So finally Conrad leaves and I go and my wife sees me and she goes, what's wrong? And I'm like, and I'm just shaking my head. And then she says, and I said, it's not bad. It's not bad. Leave me alone. And then Mike Hoop walks up. And with his wife, and I said, I just had to excuse myself. And I went in the bathroom and I had to pull myself together. It was really emotional because I felt like it's a huge deal. And for my friend to do that for me and that he thinks enough of me to do something for me like that, it really got to me. And it just seemed like telling him thank you for the rest of my life is not going to be enough for what he did. Cause he put somebody on a stage that they'd never been on. And then you think that would have been enough. And then you walk into gorilla position and there's Michael Hayes and there's the Undertaker and there's Hurricane. And, you know, by the way, Road Dogg's in my ear and there's Scott Armstrong and Dr. Tom. And, oh, look, there's Mick Foley and Bret Hart. And then you realize, oh my God, the Undertaker, Foley, Hart, Bully Ray, Diamond Dallas Page, there's Kid Rock. But how many people can say that they set
Dominic Mysterio? I mean, it was a who's who.
How many people can say that they were in the ring while the Undertaker was in the crowd watching like a fan?
Sitting next to Kid Rock.
Yeah, he don't do that.
Yeah.
So
you know, it's really cool how special of a moment it turned out to be too. I went back and watched it today. And just where it starts out, watching Conrad throw the Nux in, which was absolutely fantastic little part to go in on the finish. And then you know someone's going to run out. And the way Tony calls it, it's Dave, it's Super Dave. And it was just such a cool, fun moment. It's just so fun to go back and watch. And it's really cool that you put that together, Conrad.
It was my honor. I know he would do it for me. You know, all that matters in life, really, this is that corny cliche we've all heard. People will forget what you said and what you did, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. And I knew, hey, here's an opportunity to make my friend Dave Miller feel like $1 million for a long, long time. And it cost me nothing. Like, this isn't an inconvenience. It's not going to hurt me. Why would I not do this? I couldn't come up with a single reason not to do it. And everybody I told the idea to, they were like, are you really doing that? Oh my God. When are you going to tell him? I go, well, not before. The little fucker won't sleep for a week. So,
not.
There you go. Right backstage, right after.
Well, and you know, if I may, just real quick, with Ric Flair's last match, there were so much other things going on. You had StarCast, you had the roast of Ric Flair. I mean, it was a absolute who's who for the whole weekend. And so, how did all of this come about? I think that's probably the biggest question is, was it Ric Flair's last match? Like, that idea came up first, or was it that you wanted to produce another StarCast? How did that all get started and get that ball rolling?
Well, StarCast actually existed before AEW, and I was really excited about AEW, obviously, and they wanted me to run a convention for their first show, which was the very first pay-per-view, Double or Nothing. So I was excited to do it, and we kept it going for the next two AEW pay-per-views when they came back to Chicago for All Out, and then when they went to Baltimore for Full Gear. And then the pandemic happened. And through the pandemic, they decided, hey, we'll start doing our own fan fests and do social distancing and all that. And I just really didn't think I could do StarCast during the pandemic. So I thought, we'll just wait. So we didn't do anything at all in 2020 and 2021. And I wanted to come back with a big idea. And I was faced with a proposal that we needed to do an event to gross X number of dollars. Well, seven figures. They wanted to gross $1 million. And I had to put my thinking cap on. Okay, I definitely wanted to do another StarCast. Where could I do it? What would the idea be? And what I've always done is position StarCast not as a standalone event, but a piggyback event from where I think there might be fans flying in from all over the country. That was certainly the case with the first All In, and certainly the first AEW pay-per-view, Double or Nothing. I mean, the fly-in for those shows was crazy. So I took a look and I thought, hey, SummerSlam could be it because they're going to run a stadium show in Nashville. Nashville is a hot market and it's a fun town. Kind of like New Orleans, you can walk around and have a bunch of different, you know, booze and food and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, okay, let's look at Nashville. And the original idea was, hey, maybe I can fill this up with some other live events. So we invited Ring of Honor to do a show there. That didn't work out. We did get New Japan. And we got Black Label Pro and certainly Game Changer Wrestling. And I wanted to run, you know, I had an idea during the pandemic that we could do a fundraiser where every promotion was represented, sort of like a Brian Pillman Memorial Show. Mm-hmm. And everybody would donate all of their stuff. And it's like a telethon sort of thing to raise money for independent wrestling, just to save wrestling, sort of like Farm Aid. And so we got, through with that idea and wound up not pulling the trigger on it. But I mean, I had logos and domains and everything for it. And then I thought, man, what if I could do that? And I thought the big idea to draw a big crowd and a big gate and make it feel special. I didn't want my first foray into promoting to be quote unquote, just another show. I wanted it to be special. And the first show I was kind of loosely involved with was All In. I only say loosely involved because, you know, that Battle Royal, a lot of those folks, you know, were on the StarCast P&L in exchange for getting the soft goods to the ring. Mm-hmm. So that's how we were able to do that whole, we'll cut up the canvas and then you get this when you pre-order, blah, blah, blah. So I thought, man, I got to do something that I don't think anything will ever compete with the feeling of All In, but how close can we get? And I thought, hey, Rick, every 3 months or so, we'll call and say, hey, what do you think about? And he's low-key pitching me on the idea of one more match. Mm-hmm. So I called Rick and I said, hey, man, what do you think about one last? Yep. He cut me off. What are we doing? Who are we doing it with? When is it? And we started talking about hypotheticals. And then I saw him WrestleMania weekend and I was, you know, visiting with him just to sort of run through it and talk about it one more time. And that's when that video came out of him in a collar and elbow tie up with Ricky Morton came out. And people started speculating. And then the videos he started to post of him training with Jay Lethal, people started talking. And then, ta-da, here's the story of a man named Richard. How Jeff Jarrett tried to kill him in a parking lot. And, you know, we had fun, man. It was, I know it wasn't for everybody. And I know that online, people who didn't watch and saw memes on social had a certain opinion about it. But if you were in that building, you had a different experience. And Terry Funk once told Dave Meltzer, you know, you wrestle matches for the house in the crowd. I mean, the crowd in the house. And the people in that building that night, all I've seen is universal praise. So it's one thing to watch it on TV and on demand. And some of it holds up, some of it doesn't. But if you were in the building, it wasn't about that. It was the way it made you feel. And it was fun for me. And I think fun for everybody in attendance.
Cool.
Let me ask you, were you you know, Rick was talking about it. Did you know that eventually he was going to do it and you kind of stepped in to make sure that at least when he did it, it would be quality?
Well, what I thought was
on some indie show and somebody that'll hurt him.
No, I wasn't worried about that. I mean, he had big money offers that were guarantees in other countries, handsome sums. I mean, I'll say it. He had $100,000 offers multiple times, but I told Rick, I said, you know, The move is own part of the promotion, like participate. Don't just be a paid employee, you know, participate. So now, you know, Rick was a partner in that event. So if you came to StarCast, Ric Flair made money. If you came to the roast, Ric Flair made money. If you got a Bully Ray meet and greet, Ric Flair made money. If you bought a ticket to the show, Ric Flair made money. If you bought a pay-per-view, Ric Flair made money. If you bought an action figure or a StarCast hat, or a Ric Flair's last match shirt, Ric Flair made money. He was a partner in every piece of it. And now because of that, you know, he's part owner of the footage. And the footage of Ric Flair's last match is pretty doggone valuable. He's never owned that before. And he had never really thought about that sort of thing. I mean, he did very, very well. He said the number on a podcast once. I'm not going to repeat it, but he did very, very well. But he will continue to do well. I mean, that footage will hold value. Like, somebody is going to have a purpose for Ric Flair's last match footage one day. And when that day comes, Ric Flair or his estate will do well.
That's awesome. You know, one of the things that you mentioned, or Dave was talking about, how in the gorilla position, how you had all these different people, from Dr. Tom to Scott Armstrong and different things like that. They weren't just spectators. They were producing. I mean, you had a lot of people backstage too that were involved in the booking and the producing and, you know, agents and that kind of stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So Scott Armstrong was on the team, as was Dr. Tom and Scott D'Amore and Road Dogg and Wolfie D. And I mean, there were a lot of talent who were helping us out. Sin Bodie was there. Bully Ray agented that Battle Royal match. Yeah, I mean, it was a professionally ran production. We did a WWE style run sheet. So we had entrances and exit times. And then when the Impact crew came in, they formatted it like Impact. So I have both versions of that. It was super fun, man. I mean, we had an all-star cast putting the show together, and we were lucky enough and fortunate enough to have guys like Hurricane and Michael Hayes and Ray and Dominic Mysterio and Bret Hart and Mick Foley and Undertaker all stop by. Hard to beat.
Let me ask you, was it always your goal to mix? I mean, I know you said you had that idea in the pandemic, but do you think that I don't know how easy it was for you to get these promotions to work together, but is it safe to assume that they did it for the love of Rick?
Yeah, everybody did it out of respect for Rick. I don't think anybody, I mean, the greatest trick I thought we were able to pull off was finding a way to get Jeff Jarrett there. I mean, Jeff at the time was on the SummerSlam card the night before, and he's a vice president of WWE, tagging up with a guy who's under contract to Ring of Honor, wrestling a guy who wrestles for AEW and Ric Flair. So you had all these different promotions that shouldn't be in the same ring in the same. And yeah, the only way that would have been possible was ever out of deference to Rick. No one was going to be the promotion on record as saying, no, we won't support the Ric Flair show.
See, because I don't know if everybody knows this or not, but sometimes at wrestling conventions, take like WrestleCade, you'll have WWE contracted superstars that'll show up to do autographs, but they have to put them in a different room. They can't even be in the same room with a wrestling ring.
That's right.
Really?
So yeah. It's a big deal to get them all to work together. And was it hard to come up with finishes? I mean, was there a lot of politicking on finishes?
No. I mean, most of it we just knew going in. I mean, it's easy for people to say, yeah, you know, that this was negotiated or that was negotiated. None of that's real. I mean, most of the time we just knew going in, well, hey, they can't lose. So like in the Briscoe match, you know, respectfully, the Von Erichs weren't under contract to a television promotion. I know they'd been working with MLW, and I hope they get an opportunity to be more mainstream, as I think they're all moving to Texas now. But the Briscoes were television talent or Ring of Honor talent, and you knew they would been main eventing pay-per-views for AEW. So it wouldn't have made sense for me to go ask, hey, can you put these guys over, knowing that there's no way necessarily they're going to get a return match on AEW. So we didn't even broach that subject. We just tried to apply some common sense. The only thing that was negotiated and discussed and argued after I just said it wasn't is the main event. Rick wanted to lose. And we were like, we're not doing that. That's not what we're doing. And he was adamant. And ultimately, you know, me and Jeff and Jay and everybody else was like, dude, we're not doing that. And that was it.
What was his reasoning for, I mean, I know he's a, you know, in the wrestling business, I think that's a big thing about giving why did he want to lose that match? What was his thinking?
The time-honored tradition of wrestling is you lose on your way out. And if this really is his last match, it does him no good to win. But we would argue it does the fans no good for you to lose. And and he would also argue it's not believable that I, at 70-whatever years old, would be able to beat up either of these guys.
Right.
And that's when we came up with, what if they were brass knuckles? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we had to be able to offset the obvious of, you know, logically, could this elderly person be an active wrestler right now? Probably not.
Right. Right.
Okay. So how do we suspend our disbelief and make that make sense logically? Let's use the brass knuckles.
I mean, putting the match together, the only thing that he really bowed up on was not looking like Superman. He even said, I'm 73 years old. I'm going to look like I'm 73 years old. I appreciate what Jay Lethal and Jeff Jarrett are doing for me.
Yes.
And that's where he, that's really the only time Rick bowed up and stood his ground. And then Jeff Jarrett got his pad of paper and took over and just controlled the whole room. It was a beautiful thing.
Well, what was fun is, if you recall, and I know that people, you know, in hindsight, had lots of questions, as well they should. I understood it. But you were in the room when we're laying out the match. And sure enough, out of his own mouth, Rick goes, then I'm going to go in the corner and play dead. And we were like, huh? He goes, I'm supposed to be exhausted. We're like, yeah, but you've been doing cardio 2 hours a day for 6 months. Yeah, but I'm old. So they're going to beat me up, and then I'm just going to go to the corner and sell. I'm going to be blown up and dead and bleeding and left laying. And then here comes Manny to Andrade to just tear everybody up. And that's what we did.
One of the really fun things in that match that I really loved, I think we saw for the first and last time your lovely wife Megan get involved in professional wrestling, which I think she famously doesn't like to do or get involved much with it at all. So how much fun did she have with that? Did she enjoy the experience of actually getting in the action a little bit there?
She plays it off like she doesn't like it and doesn't care and blah, blah, blah. But it was fun because we're just north of Nashville in a gym, a warehouse, a wrestling school. But it's just a giant garage with a couple of wrestling rings. And so we're all hanging out and sort of they did the whole match. And then that's when, you know, we all had the conversation, hey, we'd like to see some physicality with y'all. And we had probably talked about that separately, but now it's the first time Karen and Megan are together sort of talking through it. And Karen said something like, hey, listen, we're not really the professionals in that regard, so let's not work it. Just hit me for real. And Megan had a vape. It's one of my favorite Megan stories of all time. She goes, that won't be a problem. As a matter of fact, like, oh, the shit you can face for real? That won't be a problem. It was so Megan. I loved it so much.
But when she said it, it put a chill in the air. Like, yeah. Me and Kyoto looked at each other like.
Right.
Because, I mean, the temperature went down in the room like she really wanted to beat the shit out of her.
Yeah.
Maybe she felt a certain way about her dad getting stabbed in the head.
The scariest member of the Flair family isn't David, Ashley, or Rick. It's Megan. She's the boss over there, for sure.
Yeah, it was. I'll never forget that either.
Well, I have another question. Rick has worn some absolute gorgeous robes. And so my question is, was he the one to decide that the major theme of the color theme was going to be purple and white? Was that his decision, or what was behind that and not a different color?
That was my idea. I just thought, hey, let's try to figure out, you know, what his, cause you know, he had replica robes made over the years. So he had like some of his famous ones recreated. And even in the WWE, there were some that were sort of homages to what came before. Like he had multiple pink robes and that sort of thing. And so I thought, you know, hey, let's try to do an homage to one that he never had recreated. He never had a replica robe made of, meaning it wasn't ring worn. It was just for appearances or whatever. Mm-hmm. And let's try to see, like, you know, how old we can get and iconic we can get. And those early Starcades were this. And there's so many iconic moments, and it was never redone. And it was sort of old school in that, although it wasn't Olivia, it wasn't exactly, didn't have the most sequence, didn't have the most flash. It too was more old school, and it was one of the first robes that he wore. And I think he said that this was the first one that Olivia made, but I've done research that says maybe that's not exactly true, but still it was one of his first ones. And I thought, hey man, it would be a cool look if we could make that ring, you know, purple and white. And so we did that. And I ran it past him, of course. I'm colorblind. I don't know that everybody knows that, but I just knew, hey, this is actually the third. He had two robes like this before made. I guess one was stolen. He had it remade. It was slightly different. We didn't know that until we had to go recreate it. But that was the idea. As I said, hey man, what about if we made a robe like this and we went with purple? And he goes, I love that. And I go, well, do you want like white this or that or purple everything? He said, purple everything. And then we talked briefly about, you know, what he wanted. And then we sent a guy to his house to measure him and make sure we had it all good to go. And the gear was made, and here we are.
It's a beautiful robe, definitely. And I think, I mean, I have my little slam buddy of him, but when I think about it, I think about the white and purple. I mean, that's like a prominent thought. So that was very good. Even though you're colorblind, you did really good on that. So
no, thank you. You know, the only time that I second guessed it is the night before when we're setting it up, Keith Mitchell was really encouraging me. Don't do white robes, do black mm-hmm. ropes. White won't look good on TV. And I said, well, it's kind of what I want. And he said, you're the boss. That's what you want. That's what we'll do. And I appreciated his expertise. So just based on that, I was like, I'm an idiot for not doing that. But I had seen all the models of this and I thought that will look cool in photos and it will make it stand out. And really that's what I was looking for. Almost everybody uses black ropes these days or red ropes, mm-hmm. but to use a white rope, it's not something you see all the time. And even when you do see it on WWE, they pair it with blue. We're pairing it with purple. It'll match the robe. It'll match the front seats, like the ringside seats. So yes. We just want to have a color and a theme and a vibe and use those type of lights in the building and all that jazz. And I was happy with it.
Yeah, it looked great. And I think that was really a very smart move because, again, when I think about it, I think about the whole – I think I got it somewhere – the Nature Boy's name written in purple and his robe and that kind of thing as part of the memory of that weekend. Cause I was there too. I think we all just, everybody was there. And like you said, it was just an unbelievable time. And like I said, purple is my favorite color. So it was just, so I really, really liked it. So I just wanted to know the thought behind it.
Well, thanks for coming. I appreciate your support. We don't always count on a big female contingent at our events. So knowing that I can always count on you to be there and support means a lot. I appreciate it.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you very much. I like being the unicorn of the wrestling.
Well, you are, and I appreciate it.
With women, we're the unicorns.
I want to circle back to the beginning of the show with the Bunkhouse Battle Royal, Conrad. Now, I know that we did that in memory of our friend Mark, who unfortunately passed away. Was Mance Warner like immediately the plan for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I did that match knowing that I was gonna, I created it for Mance to win. I wanted a way to feature all the talent I couldn't get on the show. I wanted to have a way to bring back another JCP-ism, the Bunkhouse Stampede. I wanted to have a bronze trophy boot and a belt buckle. And we did all that. And I thought, hey, this would be cool if this became a thing. Mance could then take this on some other shows and defend it and maybe wear that belt and use it as a weapon, that buckle. And as y'all know, boots. So what we did is we tried to find Austin Hall boots, and that's a pair of Austin Hall boots. And just so you know, folks who are listening, he used to make a lot of boots for a lot of the guys in the territory, like Dustin Rhodes, like Dusty Rhodes, like Barry Windham. And so he was just a famous bootmaker. So we've got those pull tabs on the side. Those are Austin Hall cowboy boots, not wrestling boots, but cowboy boots. And we took it to our local trophy shop, the pair, and had them engraved. And on that pull tab that is iconic for Austin Hall boots, there's an engraving there that said in for Mark Nelson. And then we gave the other boot, the match of the one that Mance Warner still has to this day, to Mark's Well, widow, I guess, is the word you'd call to describe our friend Allison. And it was a cool moment for us and our group chat to be able to share that with her. But all along, I knew I wanted to have a brass boot. I want to get Mance over. I want to dedicate it to Mark. So I don't need one trophy boot. I need two. And we were proud to do it. And obviously, the main event was special and important. But I would argue that for our group chat, the Battle Royal was more important. And I'm glad to say we had Mance Warner at our show. And at the next AEW TV, they booked him to take on Jon Moxley a few days later. And they even mentioned and shouted out not any other match on the card, but the Bunkhouse Stampede in honor of Mark Nelson was the only show mentioned on national, or the only match mentioned on national TV. So we had other great talent there, like Commander and a bunch of other cool cats and cool spots and cool moments, but none was maybe cooler than giving Allison that boot before the show even started, maybe 2 days before.
And did it as a GCW invasion, which made it even cooler, getting an invasion to the.
Yeah. I mean, we were strategic in not announcing any GCW talent, and it looked like we were all inclusive and we included every other promotion that we could think of, but GCW. And then, you know, at the GCW pay-per-view, we have Nick Gage come out and trash talk me, and now he's going to lead an invasion. I mean, it was kind of fun for what it was, a little old school, if you will.
Definitely. Was there anything? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Amy.
No, I was just going to say quickly, is there anything that you would have liked to have done different, or, you know, obviously in hindsight, I'm sure you all sat down after it was over and just kind of talked about what worked, maybe what didn't, what you wish now that you learned we'll do this next time. Was there anything that off the top of your head that you can think of, I'm going to do it different if I ever do this again?
Yeah. I mean, as soon as those events finish, I make pages of notes while it's fresh on my mind. Because on the heels of something like this, I never think about what went well. I just think about everything that we could have done better. And it allows me to sort of move on, just to put it on paper. Like, I won't forget it, because I feel like sometimes I beat myself up about it. If I don't do that, like, man, I got to remember to not blank again, whatever blank is. But just writing it down sometimes makes it a little more palatable for me. I mean, the biggest misstep in the whole deal was underestimating from the beginning what the appetite would be. I mean, we sold out the fairgrounds in like an hour, something like that. Right. I forget, but it wasn't substantial. And then I thought, okay, the move is I need to move, but now I've got mixed messaging because everybody and their brother's reporting that it's sold out. And I just went from a medium expense to a jumbo expense. I mean, it was $80,000 in rigging. So to say that differently, to hang the shit from the ceiling was $80,000. I mean, that's what it was. And so those things just got out of hand in a hurry. And had I started with that in mind, I would have been more profitable. It wouldn't have been an uphill battle to sell. Because as we're promoting, we're actively seeing, oh, man, too bad I missed tickets. They're sold out now. I would have loved to have come. And then when we're like, oh, no, we moved. The tickets are on sale now. Well, now it's too close. I wouldn't be able to afford the airfare or take off work now or whatever. So that was the biggest misstep. I just underestimated. I mean, listen, I'm used to running a small business. And we have people sitting on top of each other before we get a bigger office. I'm not a, if you build it, they will come type of guy from an overhead perspective. I don't get a house payment and hope I grow into it. I got to know day one, I can handle this. And so I thought, no matter what happens, I can handle the fairgrounds.
Right.
But it didn't seem like it was possible to even do that. So once it sold out, I couldn't even immediately move. AEW had a hold on the building, as did WWE. They were all in line. So they had to clear those holds. And once they, because they were going to do tryouts from WWE over there. And I guess once upon a time, AEW had a hold on it for something else. But either way, they had to clear both of them. So there was a big, you know, downtime where I legitimately was sold out for weeks. So that, in hindsight, that would have been better. But outside of that, you know, it was my first event. You don't know what you don't know. I would have handled a handful of little logistical things differently. But as far as creative, yeah, we had a bunch of different ideas that didn't wind up happening. The only one I thought did happen, and I just found out like 2 months ago, it didn't happen, is I thought that we had a story we were doing in the Four Horsemen Rock and Roll Express match. We had Nick Aldis on commentary, and my idea was maybe there becomes a circumstance where Nick sees one of the kids, as he would call them on commentary, Brock and Brian Pillman Jr. doing something incorrectly. Like he would criticize it, see it again, criticize it again, and then take the headsets off and just like storm down to ringside. And maybe we leave Tony and David Crockett talking like, man, what's gotten into him? What's going on with that? Why has he got such a vested interest in those two kids? And then at some point, it looks like Kerry is going to sneak a win, or Ricky is, and Nick Aldis takes his shoe off like J.J. Dillon, cracks one of them in the head. The kid hits the spine buster. Brock dies. Boom. Everybody wins. But then you see all those guys climbing the ring, including a now suited and booted with a vest and tie and everything else, Nick Aldis. And you see Arn Anderson, and they're all raising each other's hands, and Arn Anderson just looks and counts like one, two, three, and he counts himself, and then just shrugs and looks at the camera, and everybody raises their arms. Don't hold up four fingers. Don't acknowledge it. But I thought, man, maybe this could get some attention for AEW or some other promotion to put Brock and Brian together as a tag team, let Arn manage for them, and then maybe make it like a trios. So Arn would sort of slide into, of course, he's Arn Anderson, but he slides into the JJ role. Mm-hmm. And you got Nick there in a suit. And I thought, man, there's three out of four. They've got a natural built storyline about who is the fourth member and where could this go. But we would never acknowledge anything. But I just thought a shoe being used in a finish, that feels like JCP. Heels cheating to win, that feels like JCP. Arn getting in the ring and counting, and one of those guys is all suited up like somebody else used to be on his last show. I just thought, man, that could really work. So we laid it out, and I thought that's what it was going to be. And then I guess day of, I mean, who am I to tell, you know, Arn Anderson, my God. I don't know exactly what changed, but I know that it's Arn's match. I mean, who else do you get to agent that match? Am I going to tell Sin Bodhi or Bully Ray, go tell Arn what y'all should do? Come on.
Right.
So Arn, I guess, went with a different creative. I didn't get to see it until a couple of months ago because I just didn't sit down and watch the show again. And then I was like, wait, where was Nick? And it didn't happen. But maybe that's one of the cool what ifs. But that's the only thing we had that I thought happened that didn't happen. Everything else was, you know, in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have put as much emphasis on being a 3-hour show. I probably should have let some of the undercard matches go longer. In fairness, I didn't think Flair's thing would last as long as it did. I'm not upset by it. I'm just saying they went longer than we thought. And everybody, in trying to be deferential to Rick, went short. But, you know, 3 minutes more here, 5 minutes more there on some of the matches would have been more ideal. We were just trying to be respectful of everyone's time. I mean, I think a lot of complaints online are out there about, oh, this was a 4.5-hour show. Oh, all that. So it's like, okay, we'll be 3 hours. And we were, but I wish some of those other matches had a little more time.
Well, we had listeners send questions in, so let's try to get a few of them in because Conrad's time is short with us tonight. Who do we got? Russell Haddix wanted to know, Conrad, how did Conrad decide it was time to put on an actual wrestling show opposed to just another convention? Will he be putting on another show in the future?
It was revenue. You know, we had a goal of we needed to do a $1 million event. And I knew that if I could combine StarCast bracelet income with the meet and greet side and the pay-per-view and the roast, and then the big tentpole event being a separately ticketed wrestling show, I thought we could get there. And we did. So I think it's the second highest gross of any independent ever. I mean, I think it's all in and then this. So to be loosely associated with that and then, I guess, organize the second, that's a cool feather in my cap. And yeah, listen, I'd love to sit here and say I'm going to promote again. I do have a bunch of different ideas. I don't have a whole bunch of time. So I don't know that that will happen, but never say never, I suppose. But it would be hard to follow it up. Like, you know, no disrespect, but it's really hard to come up with, because I know people immediately said, oh, he's just going to start doing retirement matches. He's going to do this guy's last match, that guy's last match. Well, that was part of the reasoning with the name, but part of the reasoning with the name, the biggest part was from a branding perspective. I didn't want to call it Last Tango in Nashville, and people have no idea what that even means.
Right.
Say what it is. It's Ric Flair's last match. So if you went on Google and you typed in Ric Flair's last match, I knew what you would see first, and it'd be me, and I could sell you something. So that's the reason we called it that. But respectfully, And I mean that. What do I come back with now? You know, the Bubba Ray Dudley's last match. I mean, that's cool. I love Bully, but like, I don't think that, I don't think even he would say that's not really comparable. You can't really do that. And I don't mean that ugly at all. I'm just saying, even if it was a great talent who's on national TV every week, or like right now, like Christian Cage or Edge, as awesome as they are, literally everyone, no one else is Ric Flair. So I don't want to necessarily come back and do something that's lesser than. If Eric Bischoff's taught me anything, it's that I need to do something different than. So if I do another show, it probably won't be so-and-so's last match.
Cool.
Mike Bober wants to know, could the event have gone any better than it did? Was there anything that you wanted to do that you were not able to pull off?
Well, so you heard about the Brock Anderson, Brian Pillman tag team. That was a thing that I wanted to have happen, but didn't. And I would have loved to have had Hammerstone. We had a bit in there for him. He wound up missing his flight. He wasn't going to be able to make it. But Hammerstone, the MLW champion, was supposed to have a cool spot in there. What Fatu wound up doing to Frank the Clown was supposed to be Hammerstone. Him hit all of his different finishes, but the travel didn't work out. And then I wanted to have some pyro for the main event, and I wanted to have Sin Bodhi wear his exploding tie to the ring, which is just firecrackers. Mm-hmm. And we didn't think to get the fire permit in time. In my head, that wasn't something you had to plan way, way in advance, but you have to have it like 30 or 60 or 90 days in advance, and I didn't have that. So instead, we went with confetti, and I'm glad we did. I was always going to do confetti. I just wanted pyro on the entrance. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was it. But other than that, I don't think I would have changed much outside of just starting at the Municipal Auditorium.
Right.
Kyle Davis, was there one talent under a WWE contract that was close to appearing?
No one was allowed. Everyone was banned. I know people will say that and say, well, Jeff Jarrett, Jeff was agreed to do this. I had agreed to do this before he went back. So that was disclosed up front. And as anybody who's ever worked with WWE or heard about working with WWE, when they hire you, they say, do you have any outstanding commitments? Because they want you to honor those. That's just mm-hmm. the type of dude Vince is.
But he wouldn't let Charlotte be part of it. I mean, that sounds sad. No.
No, I mean, there were certain people who were told under no circumstance are you allowed to even go.
Right.
And then we saw some folks who came, but I mean, all the talent who asked to come, as I understand it, was told no. But you could see not everybody asked and went with forgiveness rather than permission. And it worked.
There you go. Josh Clemens wants to know, Conrad, we know how overwhelming a StarCast on its own can be. How did you manage your first time as a card promoter with the other activities of that weekend?
Poorly. That's how I managed it. Poorly. I mean, listen, I've got a great support cast. I can't get on here and take all the praise. I appreciate you guys heaping it on me today. It may have been my idea, but I didn't do it by myself. Steve Kay and Maureen Tracy and Dave Silva and Chris McDonald and Josh Odom and Mike Dawkins and Scott Hyatt. I mean, my entire group chat, and I guess that's part of the reason, you know, this podcast even exists. Certainly it is some of mine and even StarCast. They were there to support in droves. So just knowing I can count on people and I don't have to worry about it. That's what it is. You know, I didn't do that in the first one because I didn't know any better. I mean, I thought I was delegating stuff, but I didn't know what I didn't know. And now I know a little better. So now we've got a much bigger team and a much more. I mean, I used to sit at my computer 12 hours a day and do StarCast and then do mortgages for 8 hours a day and sleep 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to do that anymore. We've got a great team now. And, you know, we're just learning from doing. So delegating and just deciding I'll sleep next month. That's how I did it.
There you go. He's got a great team. And Conrad doesn't micromanage. He's got great people and he lets them do their job. He trusts them to do their job. And if it all goes to hell, that's when he'll step in and fix it.
Yes.
John Lopez, any stories that you can share about the after party at Tootsie, specifically anything about Kid Rock?
No, because I didn't go. I stayed at the arena a lot longer than everybody else did. I was one of the last to leave there. And then I went straight to my Airbnb and took my shoes off and made a big drink and turned on the AC wide open and just said, I can't believe it's fucking over. We did it. Like, a StarCast is overwhelming, and then a show is even more overwhelming. But now you've got somebody who's in their head and shook up and nervous and anxious and fearful. I mean, Rick was a crazy person that weekend, and it's not like he's quote unquote just a talent. This is my wife's dad. This is my father-in-law. So to have to manage all of that, well, on the one hand, looking out for him, on the other hand, trying to be a promoter who's promised fans certain things, and then he's got all the anxiety in the world. It's tough. So when it was over, I was excited to go to my Airbnb and just not have to do anything. I was finally off. Nobody needed to call or had to call, and something's an emergency. At this point, we can figure it all out Monday. So it was really nice just to, I mean, it was, I didn't sleep a lot that week, but when it was done, what a great feeling. But I did hear the next morning, all kinds of shenanigans. I can't confirm or deny, though. I wasn't there.
Ben Jones from Down Under. Conrad, when you were a kid growing up as a wrestling fan, did you ever fantasy book an event? And if so, how did that look? Was it a dream come true for you that you were able to put together this show?
It was absolutely a dream come true. It was a great honor. I don't know that I'll ever live up to it in the following act, so I'm almost hesitant to say, let's just leave it where it is. I'm sure I booked fantasy stuff as a kid with action figures when I was a little kid. I'm sure I had a full card of this guy versus that guy and all that jazz. Maybe in 97 at my peak fandom when I was 15, turning 16, I would have thought about things like, hey, what if Rob Van Dam wrestled Shawn Michaels? That'd be pretty awesome. And so sometimes maybe in that era, me and my friends would ride around and think about dream matches. Like if we were building a card, you could do this guy and that guy. But I mean, I never had like a vision for one day I'd like to put together this match. And even this main event, I mean, I knew I wanted to do Ric Flair's last match, and I knew that he didn't want to just do a match. He wanted to do a story. And I thought, okay, well, how do we get people interested in this? The documentary idea came about, and then we just sort of backed in, taking a look at the pieces. Hey, you know, if we just move this over there and we move this over here, we got a pretty cool story here. And when I pitched it to Jeff, I thought, you know, me being a rookie and having never done any of this, I was going to get my ass eat alive, and he would tell me why this was terrible and a stupid idea. Cause he's that kind of friend. He would tell me in a respectful way, that sucks. But here's how you know if Jeff Jarrett's ever going to tell you bad news or that something sucks. He'll say either respectfully or candidly. If he hits you candidly, comma, he's about to shit on you or something or someone. And if he's going to say respectfully, he's telling you in Southern terms, bless your heart, you're a dumbass. I was ready to get one of those, and I didn't. He goes, that's really fucking good. Can you write that down and send that over to me? So he didn't say fucking, I did though. And so then I sent it over to him and he liked it. And so then he said, has Rick signed off on this? I said, no, I wanted you to shit on it first. He goes, I think it's really good. And so I sent it to Rick and he liked it too. So it was like, okay, I guess this is it. And I sent it to a few other people, but that's all I can share probably.
Adam Jefferson, on an episode of Zipco Bros, I discussed real Jeff Jarrett masterfully handling the room when putting together the match. Can we get any more info on that backstage moment?
Well, they had worked the match out and actually had the match done three times. They had three practices. So they all knew the match forwards and backwards and were good to go. But then, you know, Rick was in his head. So he wanted to get everybody in the room with the referee and everybody and talk through it. The trouble was Andrade and Charlotte were late to the building. So when they finally got there, it was a high pressure situation because Rick had been waiting for a while and Jeff was sort of nervous because Rick was nervous. And then they started laying out the match and Charlotte had her opinions and expressed them. And eventually, you know, there was discussion about maybe changing a few things, and eventually they got it figured out. But yeah, I think, you know, Rick said, hey, just talk me through it. And then Jay starts talking and Manny starts talking and they would make suggestions and they would run it past Jeff and Rick, and then it was finalized. Okay, here's what we're doing. So they ran through it one more time once the debate was over, make sure everybody was on the same page. And then everybody went to their respective rooms and started getting ready.
All right. There another one? That's all of them.
Yay.
All right. We did it, guys.
Conrad, we can't thank you enough for joining us tonight. We hope you'll come back again. I could talk to you for hours. I mean, especially just from what I've heard you do this week, I could probably spend another hour with you just picking your brain, especially with this new Kevin Sullivan show.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. We're having a good time with it. I hope you guys will continue to support it. I thank the world of Mr. Sullivan and hope that he continues to have a bunch of success with us, because I'm having a blast just picking his brain and sitting under his learning tree. But thanks for having me on. I'd be glad to come back anytime. And, I hope we're talking about Ric Flair's last match again in 4 years for the 5-year anniversary, because, look at what Killer Cross went on to do. I mean, Karrion Kross was on TV almost right away. And now Commander just the other day wrestled Chris Jericho. And it's pretty crazy. And I can't wait to see, like Nick Wayne, we had him a year early. It's craziness. And I hope that, that show continues to grow in legend in the years to come. And I appreciate all that you did to make it special, Ponwater.
Well, I appreciate it. That show stood on its own without the main event.
I think so.
I mean, my wife said that she was ready for more wrestling before the main event started. She was upset that there wasn't more. That's how good it was.
Yes. Well, I appreciate her saying that. I felt the same way. I really enjoyed the undercard, and I hope to get to do something like that again someday soon. I've just got to have the right idea.
Well, thank you for your time tonight, Conrad. I love you, brother.
Hey, love you guys too. Thank you all for having me very much. And Justin,
I'm looking forward to seeing you in September.
I'll see you then. I won't step on your intro next time. I thought you were struggling.
stay off my intro, Conrad. Damn.
Hey, I will say that at least you motivated him. We're on the 39th episode, and last night for the first time he ever wanted to do a sound check. So thank you for lighting a fire under his ass.
Well, thank you guys very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
thank you for stopping by.
Absolutely. See y'all.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Conrad Thompson, how great was that, everybody?
That was so great. I love hearing all that backstory.
The dude is one of my best friends. Stuff. The dude was one of my best friends, and I'm getting ready to press play, and I'm shaking like a dog trying to pass a peach seed. I wasn't this nervous for Ric Flair's last match. My friends were asking, and Amy and Justin said, what are you so nervous for? And I said, because we're doing a podcast with a guy that does podcasts better than anybody that does podcasts.
Exactly. That can definitely be nerve-wracking. But he was exactly like he normally is. He was wonderful. And I think everybody had great questions. And wanting to know that backstories.
And I apologize to the live audience. I wanted to get to your questions. I felt like I owed it to the people that posted their questions online to get those in first. Unfortunately, we couldn't keep Conrad longer tonight, but I promise you that I'll get him back again. I've wanted him on the show for a long time, but I didn't want to just bring him in. I felt like the anniversary of Ric Flair's last match was a good reason to have Conrad on. He's such a good person. He's good at what he does, man. And I just love him so much. And I knew him before he started podcasting. Our bond is, you look behind me, you see all these wrestling belts. We're belt collectors. The belt collecting hobby is how we know each other. Belt collectors meeting at Legends Fan Fest, which is now The Gathering, which is going on right now as we speak in Charlotte, North Carolina. Us meeting and going to that event, we started a group chat so we could coordinate meeting up. And almost 10 years later, that group chat's still going. That's our group chat. Mm-hmm. And
did he ever put in the group chat, hey, I was thinking about doing this podcast thing? I mean, like, did he throw it out there to y'all? And then, like, what do y'all think? Or
called the think tank. We were his think tank. Yeah, he used to bounce ideas off of us. Mark Nelson named StarCast.
Yeah, really.
I named Grill and JR.
Awesome.
Now, it wasn't hard to come up with that. I typed it in before somebody else. I mean,
so what does he call you now? If you're not Think Tank, what does he call you?
Well,
now?
The free show started and they needed content. So the group chat started out the first couple of episodes as the Think Tank. Mm-hmm. And then we became the Sad News Bears.
Yeah. Oh, so yes, that's yes, what's, yes.
Because you can always count on our Scott Hyatt putting a natural disaster in the group chat. And you can count on Dave Hancock. Sometimes you want to just throw the Debbie Downer gif at him because the wah, 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 because it, it was something for everybody.
Yes.
And we've actually got a Sad News Bears graphic with emergency lights on it that now we try to drop it in when we're going to give bad news.
Oh, I see. So everyone that was on Sad News Bear, you all are all belt collectors, or that's how you all met.
Most of us were. Then we had some some of them that weren't belt collectors that came into the group became belt collectors.
Sure. That's so cool. Rotten
Crotch. He wasn't a collector.
No, Rotten Crotch is, I know Rotten Crotch from the old belt groups.
Oh, okay.
Dave Silva, right? He wasn't
Silva
a belt
wasn't
collector.
A belt collector. Silva doesn't collect belts. He collects, he's got quite a memorabilia collection.
Sure.
So
that's really cool how that, you all were friends way before he thought a podcast. I mean, he was a mortgage broker. You know what I mean? Like, that's what he did.
And I mean, he dropped in the group chat one time and said, "Hey guys, I'm going to Atlanta. I'm going to sit in on Ric Flair's doing a podcast for CBS. I'm going to sit in." And then he came back and said, "Hey guys, I end up on air with Rick." And then he was like co-host.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, then it was, you know, we knew he was hanging out with Bruce, and then all of a sudden the idea for Bruce, and then
right.
I mean, Bruce would be floating in his pool, and Conrad would come home and turn the music off and change it to John Cena's theme, just to screw with Bruce. But I mean that. But though he started, but have it hanging out with Bruce because Bruce was working with him a little, and
right.
That's where that cat podcast came from. And then he's like, "What about Tony Schiavone? What about Eric?" I mean. And then it steamrolls. And then when, you know, so the group chat, we basically, it was just, that's where it all came from.
Right. And you know what I think is really remarkable? And again, I think this speaks of Conrad and probably his character. You all are still his friends. You know what I mean? I mean, like, and a lot of you all, again, he thought specifically of you as his friend to be in the last match. And you know, some of the other people that he named, I know Mike Dawkins is one. I just heard him talk about, but I'm just saying that, you know, I think that that's wonderful that, you know, sometimes people could, you know, maybe decide that they don't need that, you know, like
I thought I was going to get to do the Bunkhouse Battle Royal.
Sure.
And I've gave the boot to Mansur because of Mark.
Right.
Which, you know, that's another highlight. That moment means as much to me as the counting to three for Rick moment.
Right.
Believe it or not. But just getting to do that. And we love Mance.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sometimes you'll hear Conrad tell Tony, "Man, Rebel's really over in the group chat." Well, Mance Warner's really over in the group chat too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been singing Mance's praises for years.
Yeah, well, he used to do that show with Lauren, you know, like mansplaining.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a great show.
I mean, longer ago than that. I mean, sure. Mance was on Conrad's radar and Scott's radar, and we love Mance. So getting to do that, and Mark would have loved that. So mm-hmm. me just doing that part, because I'm an indie referee. I'm not a television referee. I'm just on the independent circuit. And now, but going out in front of that arena and being on, I'm not nervous in front of people. So mm-hmm. that wasn't the issue, but I knew that I had to up my game that night because I worked with, there's a difference in being a referee, an indie referee, and being a television referee. Television's a different animal.
Sure.
And
did they have to give you, I mean, like,
oh yeah, they gave me pointers.
They gave me pointers.
it's just the hard camera and trying not to get you back. It's
sure, sure.
And honestly, I think I would have done much better that night if I didn't have the earpiece in. Because I don't normally wear an earpiece.
Right.
So if I was going to give a referee starting out any kind of advice, seek out a promotion that does television and go to them and learn television wrestling. Because you can do television wrestling, you can do arena wrestling.
Right.
And like I said, there was a lot of good referees on that show. I mean, a lot of them. And I enjoy working with, to me, anytime I can be on a show with better referees is great because you only get better working with better people. And, sure. And who gets better than Mike Chioda? And I start naming off the other guys, but if I leave one out, I'd be scared to leave one out. So, cause I mean, Derek Sabato, I'm not going to do it because I'll forget one of them.
Right. They're all
incredible referees.
Yes.
And they were all supportive of what I was getting to do. Now, I didn't even talk about after Conrad told me, I didn't tell anybody. Uh-huh. Nobody. My wife's the only person that knew. But I had to tell her because I was losing my shit after Conrad told me. So I didn't have her work because, you know, I couldn't come up with anything different to tell her.
Right. You had to tell somebody. Had to get it out.
Yeah. I mean, so I had to tell her because I was so emotional. But like I knew Cassio knew and Cassio knew I knew, but I wouldn't confirm it. Because I'm like, if this is a test, if I can keep a secret.
Oh, look, there's a great picture of all y'all.
Yeah, we all got together for the picture, and they was like, what should we do? And I said, let's all throw it. It's for Rick. Let's throw up the four.
Right.
So, anyway, but all day long, I'm like Dawkins. They all knew before me. Nobody told me, but I wouldn't confirm to them that I knew. And I didn't say anything to anybody at the building. I mean, it's probably the show had already started before the other guys figured out I was the run-in ref. Because until it was discussed in front of them, I wasn't up in anything.
Right. How worried were you that you were going to fall?
That's really the only thing. And when I tell you that I was like, be Charles, not Titus, be Charles, not Titus, be Charles, not Titus. That's what was going through my mind when my little ass was running down the ramp.
Oh, my God. I think I would. Yes, I could have. I mean, that would be a scary thought. So many things would have to be going on, but you didn't. And that's the best thing. And you slid right in there. And
I've done it. I've ran to the ring and slid in before. I wasn't worried about it. I mean, like I said, I wasn't a television referee, but I've been refereeing for a long time. I know what I'm doing.
Did Stephanie have that shirt on? Like, I'm here for the ref.
Dave t-shirt on.
Oh, I was going to say.
Watch the match. When they show Kid Rock, she's right behind him with a camera.
Okay. Okay.
She took that iconic picture that's online of Conrad shooting Jeff Jarrett the finger.
I know.
She was right behind Conrad.
Yeah, we just saw it. I think she posted it at the very end of the show.
But again,
at the end of Conrad being here.
I just want everybody in the chat to know tonight that I appreciate y'all being here. Appreciate your support. I really apologize. It wasn't because our producer wasn't telling us, hey, you need to start asking questions. It's just that I didn't want to cut short. I'm trying to get in what we wanted to get in with Conrad. We could definitely do a part two with him. But I also felt the obligation that if I ask y'all online for something and y'all do it for us, then I want to honor that. And I really wanted to honor the group, the chat, the live chat as well. We just ran out of time. And for that, I apologize. We had trivia and we skipped trivia to get right to Conrad. And in honor of Conrad, his favorite year of wrestling being 89. Amy's trivia tonight is on 1989.
Exactly. And not just 1989, but Saturday night main events in 1989, which I know if you're like me, that Saturday night main event was a must see. And so I have been watching them again for the last couple of days, and I am falling back in love with them is all I'm saying. So, all right. First question.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to remember how I felt about Saturday Night's Main Event in 1989. Because it preempted Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Was Tully and Arn on this? Were Tully and Arn on this show? They were?
They were on there?
Yeah.
Then this one didn't. Then this one didn't piss me off. But most of the time, it pissed me off that they preempted Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
Because I was an NWA guy.
I'm going to say.
Really? Was 89 a good year for Saturday Night?
Yeah.
I'll say, was 89 a good year for Saturday Night Live?
Saturday Night's Main Event, I think. I don't know.
Go ahead and ask your question. Sorry. I don't know.
I don't know. I
would
know
not have guessed.
I feel like my ears pieces are going out. Oh. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can hear me? Okay. I'm sorry. How many episodes of Saturday Night's Main Event did we see in 1989? 4, 5, 6, or 7?
Yeah, I'm going to say 6.
I'm going to say 4. Because I thought that was high. I didn't think they were doing them that many times a year.
Well, in 89, they were. They did 6 of them. They actually they had 2 main events. So they actually had 8 different shows on mainstream television. So their 6 episodes were January 7th, March 11th, May 27th, July 29th, October 14th, and November 25th. Those were the 6 that they had in 1989.
I did not realize they did that many.
Yeah, and at this point, you're still just having really 4, you know, the big 4, the pay-per-views, the WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series. This actual year, 1989, they had, it wasn't televised, but they had the King of the Ring. I don't remember. Let me make sure it's not a question. No, I believe, I don't remember who won it. I want to say Tito Santana actually won the King of the Ring in 1989. But like I said, it wasn't televised. It was a house show.
Well,
so they were doing a lot.
To circle back what you said about was Saturday Night Live good in 1989?
Yeah.
The cast was Dana Carvey, Nora Dunn, Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks, Victoria Jackson, John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, and Kevin Nealon. And the featured players were A. Whitney Brown, Al Franken, Mike Myers, and Ben Stiller. Saturday Night Live was still hitting really hard in 1989.
If Phil Hartman's on the cast, then it's a good season.
Heck yeah.
I'm sure he was doing Caveman Lawyer.
Exactly. Yes, those were definitely good. So there was all kinds of good stuff. All right.
That was the debut year for Mike Myers.
1989? Oh, man.
And he was just a feature. He wasn't a Not Ready For Primetime player yet.
Really? I did not realize he was ever a feature. So he came on full time.
I didn't remember Ben Stiller being a feature on there.
I feel like I did. Did he end up being a writer?
At the time they were all writers and they'd write stuff to get themselves on the show.
Yeah. Right.
They had to come up with stuff to get themselves on the show.
Got you.
Because I think Mike Myers said more and more his stuff was hitting with Lorne.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, because they would pitch, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so back to Saturday Night's Main Event.
This is why we skipped trivia and got Conrad in.
Exactly. As you could tell.
Turns in a NASCAR race.
So Hulk Hogan main evented all 6 of the Saturday Night Main Event shows in 1989. Which one of the following wrestlers was not in the main event with Hulk Hogan? Was it The Genius, Bad News Brown, Rick Martel, or the Honky Tonk Man? So he was the main event for all 6 of those Saturday Night Main Events, but one of these wrestlers was not in the main event with him.
I'm thinking, man, the chat's overwhelmingly going Rick Martel. Steve, but I'm thinking it was Bad News Brown.
I think he fought Bad News Brown. Martel was my first thought. I'm going C2.
Look at Justin. That is correct. It is Rick Martel. He did end up wrestling all these other people. I believe Bad News Brown was the March 11th episode.
Okay. Yeah.
Only because on that episode is when Miss Elizabeth had to say who she was going to be in the corner of for WrestleMania 5. And she said she wasn't going to be on either one of their corners. So that's why I remember that episode. All right, next question. Who did Hulk Hogan wrestle and defeat in the Big Blue Cage on the May 27th episode of Saturday Night's Main Event? Was it Big Boss Man, Bad News Brown, Akeem, or Big John Studd?
Hey, Big Boss
Man. Hey, Boss Man. Tony Schiavone talks about that match, so they were doing it around the horn.
Oh, so yes, you all are all correct. It was the Big Boss Man in the Big Blue Cage. Which I like, just because it's iconic, I guess. I don't know.
I don't like the Big Blue Cage. I never liked the Big Blue Cage.
Why? Because it just doesn't look like a cage? Or why? Why don't you like the Big Blue Cage? Because
I... See, I come from a time when you used a chain link fence and you ran their faces into it.
Right. You wanted the real cage.
Like, I don't want big steps. I don't want... I mean, the idea is not to escape the cage. So you don't need a rebarb ladder.
I gotcha.
So I never liked it because WWF cage matches all sucked because you're trying to escape.
JB says Pondy's got heat with blue cages.
Hey, if you're a hero, you win. You don't run.
No, that's very true. I mean,
y'all know I'm not real big anyway.
Yeah.
But when I was in school, I was really small. I had two choices, get my ass kicked or run. So I guess if I went to WWF, because I could get away from anybody with the ninja quickness, I could have been WWE champion in a cage because I can escape with the best of them.
My finishing move
is tennis shoes.
Tennis shoes. You're so silly. Alrighty. I do agree, Mike Bober put, I hate the escape rule. I do agree with that. That does seem kind of weird that you would, that's the way you would win. So, number four, this is a short answer, okay? So, along with Hulk Hogan being in a steel cage match, there is something else very special about this particular Saturday night main event, the May 27th episode, that happened on this episode that did not happen on any other Saturday night main event in 1989. Can you tell me what that was? Something happened.
I have no idea.
Something happened on this particular Saturday night main event that did not happen on any of the other ones in 1989.
I hated the short answer questions in school, too.
Well, I mean, Elizabeth making her decision on who she was going to go with.
No, that was March. That was March.
Oh.
Because she did that before WrestleMania. This is May. May 27th. Anybody in the chat have a guess? Zeus.
Kerry Von Erich won the Intercontinental title?
No.
No.
I have no clue. What is it?
All three belts. So you had your heavyweight title belt, your tag team title belts, and your Intercontinental Championship belt. All three were defended on this episode. That is not something that was usually done on Saturday night main event. So
was Kerry the Intercontinental Champion? Did he defend against Mr. Perfect?
I think so. I'm feeling like, yes, he defeated. Did he win?
I thought that was 90, not 89.
I feel like
Curt Hennig did wrestle.
It might have been later because Flair and Kerry were there at the same time.
Darn it.
Yeah, World Class hadn't closed down yet. It wasn't 89.
Yes. So he wrestled somebody, but I don't remember who. Sorry. So, like I said, typically that did not happen. Having championship matches, even Hogan, when he did win the championship later in the year, not all his matches were for the title. So I thought that was kind of cool. All right, last question. Out of the six matches that Hogan wrestled on Saturday Night Main Event, he only lost one. Who defeated Hulk Hogan at the Expo Center in Topeka, Kansas on November 25th, 1989? Was it Akeem, the Genius, Ted DiBiase, or the Honky Tonk Man?
This is the genius.
That is correct. The only one out of all these gentlemen who did wrestle him there that has a win over Hulk Hogan is the Genius. It was by count out, but a win's a win, right?
So, that's right.
Yay!
Like Mance says, that's all that matters when you go to the pay window.
Exactly.
Hitting that pay window.
Because that's going to bother me now. So thank y'all for doing my trivia. That was fun. I did it, like you said, we did it in honor of Conrad's love of 1989 and Saturday Night Main Event. Who didn't love that, right?
I did it for the Conrad.
You're so silly.
Well, does that wrap us up? Dave, what we got here? We going home, as they say?
We're going to take it on home. We've said it all. We've said enough.
We've said way too much.
Like and subscribe. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're at 107 subscribers. We appreciate every one of you.
Hit the little ring bell thing. Subscribe, leave a 5-star review, do all that good stuff over there. We really had a good time bringing in the Podfather, Conrad Thompson, who, you know, gave us a look into what it was to put together Ric Flair's last match, which, of course, Dave was there for. And, you know, Dave, I watched it again today, and I get goosebumps every time I see Dave running down that ramp and Tony yelling. It really did get me all in the feels again watching it today. So,
man, definitely. I was anxious last night watching it. I watched it last night, and I wasn't anxious that night. God, I'm mighty watching it. There comes a part of the match when my stomach started churning.
Really?
Yeah, I got really anxious. I had to turn off the Von Erich Briscoe match.
Hmm.
Were you afraid you're going to see something that you did wrong or something? I don't know.
I can't explain it. I just got really, really uncomfortable watching the match. It was making me so anxious.
Uh-huh.
And I thought the Von Erich Briscoe match was great. I don't think I made any mistakes in that match.
Right. Well, I mean, I just meant, is that what you were afraid of? I'm not saying you were making mistakes. I just didn't know.
But I didn't feel that way that night. I mean, I had the butterflies. You're always going to get the butterflies before you go through the curtain. When you don't get the butterflies anymore is when you got to quit doing it. But, I mean, it's just like a wave hit me of being really, really anxious. And I can't explain it. But, I mean, it was a good anxious, I guess. I'm just, you know, and when I saw it and I heard David Crockett and Tony Schiavone are my all-time favorite broadcast crew.
And you could tell, you could tell on this show too, Tony knew he wasn't on like TV. Like he was a little bit looser with his comments and a little more fun on the commentary. And I really enjoyed that part.
Man, David Crockett made some really good points too. Like the little subtleties he would point out. And I thought that was a nice touch. Like he said, Jay Lethal's the one that's been wrestling with him. So Jeff Jarrett may know what Jeff may know what Rick can do, but Jay knows what he can't do.
Right.
So
who doesn't love David Crockett? I mean, seriously.
Man, it came up on my, it's actually on my Facebook page today. I met David Crockett, at the gathering, the NWA Legends in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. He came in and talked to Tony, and then I caught him as he was leaving and got a picture with him. But I told him, I said, man, you and Tony were my favorites.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me like I was crazy, but he was, because when Magnum was kissing Baby Doll, he's like, look at her. She likes it, Tony. I mean, he didn't have a problem calling wrestlers on their bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a fan being at the podium. And that's what I love about it. It just felt good. It felt good listening to him. And I've always loved Tony. And so when we were down there and after Tony interviewed Rick after the match and we were walking back up the ramp, Tony goes, I can't wait for you to hear the playback. He goes, I gave you the Sting treatment. So as soon as Efren sent me a clip, Efren sent me like a 19-second clip and I heard Tony go, it's Super Dave. Man, you could have knocked me over with a feather. There's just so much. And I had no idea that night how great the following year was going to be.
Sure.
Because I'd go.
Oh,
I mean, make no bones about it. I'm just a referee. We're just referees. Kyoto's tell you, referees don't sell tickets. We comp them. So, but I mean, every locker room I've been in, wrestlers, referees, promoters are so happy for me that I got to have that opportunity. Wrestlers that I worked with in Texas were inboxing me or posting because they said it was one of theirs that got to do that because we all came up at PCW. You know, Kyle Davis was one of the ones that asked questions. Kyle Davis was at PCW when I started.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a manager, became an announcer, good friend. Great strategy when he's in a rumble match. He just grabs the bottom of bottom rope and hugs it and won't move. but to just the support that I've gotten from so many different wrestlers, so many and the fans, and it's just I've had a great year. I mean, referees don't normally have promo pictures. I've had promo pictures that, you know, because people actually wanted them. I've got to sign autographs. It's pretty cool. It's a cool feeling, and I'm blown away every time somebody asks. It's been a good year, and I'll never forget what Conrad's done for me, because I'll be the first to, and I was told when I got in the wrestling business, it's not how good you are. It's the right person seeing if you're doing what they're looking for at the right time, then that's how you advance. Mm-hmm. Like Ellsworth was in the right place at the right time.
Sure.
And I'm not saying Ellsworth's not talented. When I say this, I'm just using it as an example. But Zach Gowan.
Mm-hmm.
They needed that. You know, they needed that. And I mean, look what he did for Brock, how Brock got mega heat beating up a one-legged man.
Right.
So, I mean, Hornswoggle, it's what they're looking for.
Right.
They're looking for at that time. And so, I mean, that's what I was told. So when people say, how did you get that gig? I say, well, I'd like to tell you it's because I was 17 years in the wrestling business and I paid my dues and kept my ears open and my mouth shut. And when opportunity presented itself, no, I got it because of that man on the screen right there, because my best friend's a promoter and he wanted that for me.
Right.
And well, in wrestling, that's a good thing.
Yes. But plus two, he knew you could do it. You know, I mean, he wouldn't send you out there to fail. He knew you could do it. You know,
think of the content he would have had if I did.
No, I don't mean it. Like, I'm just saying.
But he knew you could. Oh, he was going to win either way, Amy.
Well, I guess he is. He's always thinking. Oh. That's probably true. You're right. He probably had another one just in case Pondwater wipes out.
I'm going to share one last story, and I probably told it before, but I'm going to tell it again anyway, because I love Jeff Jarrett. We got off to a shaky start because I insulted him. But
what? How'd you do that? What'd you do?
Well, sometimes you have things built up in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You have things built. I'm holding the real gold belt there on the screen right now. If you're listening to the podcast, you got to come watch us on YouTube. See. The great job that our producer Stephanie does. The first time I held that belt, I almost hyperventilated. She had to tell me to breathe. It's the first time I've been starstruck by an inanimate object. But anyway, back to Jeff Jarrett. We're sitting in the green room in Chicago. And I saw Jeff Jarrett defend the NWA World title against Tully Blanchard in 2005 in Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. Les Thatcher was sitting next to me. Tully wrestles a different style than the current wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And Jeff was sucking wind. I didn't ask him this question to be insulting because I know we used to mat wrestle. When we used to mat wrestle in training, I would blow up a lot quicker than I did when we were just doing spots and stuff. But the actual on the grappling will blow you up quick, especially me because I'm out of shape. My first move when we got to training was grab a trash can and pull it close to the ring so I'd have somewhere to throw up. And that's so anyway, I asked Jeff, what'd Tully Blanchard do to blow you up in 2005? Well, the way I was going to ask him is, what did Tully, I wanted to hear talk about what was going on different that Jeff was accustomed to in TNA. What was going with an old school guy like Tully? I wanted to hear the differences. Mm-hmm. Problem was, as I'd been drinking all day, so what was going on in my head did not come out of my mouth hole in a way. So I said it, and Jeff looks at Conrad, and Conrad looks at Jeff, and they both look at me, and I knew that I had screwed up. But Jeff laughed it off, and I mean, we're fine. I mean, it's probably a friendship came out of it. So it, you know, but I wouldn't suggest, I know that there's probably a guitar in my future. I should have said respectively.
Yeah.
But anyway, when I got to the arena, I walked in and I was looking around, empty arena. And I walked up to the ring and I turn around and look, and here comes Jeff Jarrett down the ramp. And he said, Palmwater, tonight I'm going to need you, when you run out, to run down and touch the ring and then run all the way back up the ramp and touch the podium. And then run all the way back down, touch the ring again. I'm going to need you to do that three times before you slide in, because I need you good and blown up when you start counting. And I laughed and I told him three times. Like it would take three times.
Oh. Well, we do want to say we want to thank all of those guys in the chat that joined us tonight. Terry Weaver, Allison Faye, JB, Mike Bober, all those people. I saw Coach Rosie in there, all kinds of people in there with us tonight. Thank you so much.
Yeah. We got Matt Presley. Us. He says he's
Matt
new.
Presley, love that first yeah. time.
Yes. Yep. Well, we like our first timers. Thank you for joining
That's
us.
Right. Can we take Absolutely. How many times does it take? How many times you got to do something before it becomes a habit?
Three.
There you go. See you next week.
All right. Well, for the First Lady, the Arn Anderson Fan Club, Miss Amy Vaughn, for Teppy Miller, our producer, for Pondwater Dave Miller, and my name is Justin Davis saying, take care of yourself and each other. So long, everyone.